This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack in for Faith. This show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. There's a phrase that conjures up images and memories of the 1960s. But of course, it wasn't all peace and love. The counterculture was completely intertwined with the serious challenges and changes that swept America in that decade. From civil rights and women's rights to the trauma of Vietnam and the anti-war movement. The violence, turmoil, and clashes between the generations paved the way for a surge in self-expression and creativity. We saw it through protests on college campuses, we watched it in the marches, and, maybe most of all, we heard it in the music that would become the common thread that wove it all together. As rock music became a force of change, a young kid from the Bronx named Richard Goldstein launched his career as a music journalist and set off on his own revolutionary path, creating a new genre of criticism at the Village Voice and becoming an influential commentator on culture, politics, and sexuality. He's written for the New York Times, Harper's, New York Magazine, The Nation, and other publications. He's served as executive editor of The Village Voice and is the author of several books. His latest is called Another Little Piece of My Heart, My Life of Rock and Revolution in the 60s. Richard Goldstein joins us today by phone from New York. Welcome to the show.
Very nice to be with you.
Nice to have you. This memoir is pretty open and honest, not only about the events of the time, but about your own experiences. You write with candor about your sexuality, shyness, racial tensions that most of us might not have the courage to admit. Why did you want to write this book?
Well, first of all, I'm getting to a certain age where you either write it or you lose it. And secondly, I read Patti Smith's memoir called Just Kids about her youth and her relationship with the photographer Robert Mapplethorpe. And I thought the complexities of that book were so fascinating. And it takes place in a similar milieu to mine. So it kind of inspired me to try to do this. It's something I hesitated about for a long time, partly because it's so embarrassing. And then I realized that if you're going to write a memoir, you have to be willing to embarrass yourself, especially if it's about your youth, because youth is generally an embarrassing thing. So I decided that if I was willing to embarrass myself, I could go ahead and write all of my tales.
Glad you did. You had unprecedented access to musicians and artists like Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Allen Ginsberg, Andy Warhol. The list is very long. You even maintained personal relationships with some. Can you talk about what that experience was like and what it was like to write about them?
Yeah. Well, first of all, this was a time when press agents and publicists had much less power than they do today. And so it was possible to be with a musician or a band very informally with no mediation, no interference for, you know, maybe a week at a time, touring with them, watching them record and what have you. And they just basically were there with me and they behaved. There was no kind of inhibition about it. And sometimes, you know, we would get stoned together. This was a kind of a ritual of trust. And so there was a real intimacy that was possible with these people. And that's what I remember most, was how easy it was to get very close to them. You know, that's a very different world than today, where you have elaborate negotiations for every interview. You get 15 minutes, you're 3,000 miles away. They're on the phone or they're Skyping. There's no sort of flesh contact at all, and you never really get to know them. So I was fortunate enough to be doing this as a young man. I was their age. I had exactly their class background and their educational background, and we had values in common as well. We were all members of the counterculture. So all of this made it possible. A real intimacy ensued in a lot of these encounters. So I got to watch, you know, Janis Joplin really display her insecurity and Jim Morrison record while, you know, drunk, and Brian Wilson in a sort of drug-filled weekend in Palm Springs, and on, you know. And, you know, it was really an indispensable experience for me. And so, of course, I got to care for a lot of these people very much. And when they met untimely ends, which occurred in a lot of cases, it was a very painful thing for me to go through. So those are my basic sort of memories, both the startling intimacy, the feeling of oneness with them, and then the pain at their deaths.
You weren't always able to talk about, in your writing, the drug use that you saw among musicians. Can you explain why?
Well, you know, it wasn't just the musicians who were using drugs. It was, you know, millions and millions of young people. With musicians, you know, there could be harder drugs in use, heroin, for instance, or amphetamines. I mean, you know, all I can say is this is a long history of musicians doing this, and it has to do, I think, with accessing the subconscious. Some people are fortunate enough to be able to be in touch with their innards creatively without any kind of mediation, but a lot of people need something like this to get the creative edge out. And musicians rely on drugs for many reasons, including the hectic pace of their lives. But they also rely on drugs in order to get into a meditative state so that they can essentially report their meditations to the world. And that's, I sort of have a certain respect for why musicians use drugs very often. It's obviously very risky behavior. Mm-hmm. And here I'm talking about very dangerous drugs, not marijuana, for instance. But, you know, it's a given that, in fact, visionaries will try to alter their consciousness by any means necessary in order to access their visions. And that's what they're paid for. They're paid to give us their visions. So this is something I kind of accepted in them.
Was that difficult?
I think it was difficult to see them in such bad shape, those who were involved with heroin or amphetamines. I mean, for instance, Jimi Hendrix, I saw with kind of a vomit-stained shirt, and he was in kind of a stupor. He had no idea who I was, and I certainly couldn't conduct an interview with him in that state. So I sort of sat there respectfully for about 5 minutes, and then I said, I'll come back another time.
Yeah, and you talk about that in the book. You say you were kind of shocked that musicians and artists would actually agree to speak to a journalist in that state. And you didn't write about that. You were protecting him?
Yes. You know, drug laws in those days were so harsh that it would have felt like a betrayal to report this. I mean, a musician who has been caught with heroin cannot perform in a club. At least in those days, that was the law. And this had happened to Billie Holiday and Lenny Bruce and a number of artists who were really great artists. Their livelihoods were taken away from them. So to report that, you know, somebody was using heroin or had evidence of that would be to open them up to complete destruction. And there was no way that I was going to do that. So for that reason, you know, I mean, I would report psychedelics or marijuana because everybody used those things. But the harder drugs, I was very reluctant to get into and kept it to myself. And, you know, whether this actually ended up abetting their damage, I don't know. And I used to feel very bad when I would read that, in fact, they had overdosed. But on the other hand, it was a real bind for a journalist, you know, given the consequences of people knowing what they were up to.
Sure.
So, yes, I didn't report it.
You were starting your career at an interesting time in journalism. I'm thinking about the style of new journalism. Can you explain what that is and give your thoughts about that?
New journalism is a technique of using fictional devices in order to report the truth. So the story is written like a short story rather than like a piece of reportage. And this really opens up the possibilities of literary writing. You have to be completely accurate. I mean, that's one of the requirements of the form, but the way you write the story, the voice you use as a narrator, the way you use dialogue, the scenes that you set up, all they really are kind of borrowed from the techniques of realist fiction. So essentially, I was writing a series of short stories about real people in the real words they used, but the descriptions and the ambience I created were drawn from my readings in fiction. And to me, that's the new journalism. It's a very commonplace form today, but in the 60s, it was new.
I want to take a break right here. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with journalist and author Richard Goldstein. He joins us today by phone from New York to talk about his book, Another Little Piece of My Heart, My Life of Rock and Revolution in the 60s. I'm Laurie Mack, sitting in today for Faith Middleton. We'll be right back. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, sitting in for Faith. We're talking today with Richard Goldstein. He's the author of Another Little Piece of My Heart. It's a memoir of his life and career as a journalist and rock critic in the 1960s. He joins us today by phone from New York. Richard, I want to go back to your writing for a minute. You say you saw writing as a shelter from self-exposure. What did you mean?
Well, you know, I don't think a lot of people write because they're happy with the way the world is and they're happy with their place in it. I think most people who write are fundamentally dissatisfied and wish to create a world which is inhabited by their friends. I certainly this was true for me as a boy and as an adolescent. The way I dealt with my feelings of alienation and sort of emotional pain was to retreat into a world that I created through writing. And throughout my entire life, writing has basically been what has kept my equilibrium as a person. So I still do it every day. I have to. It's kind of a ritual that keeps me whole. And I just think this is true for many writers that I've met. If you dig deeply enough, you see a child in pain, either because there's pain around him or her, or because there's interior pain. And writing, maybe art in general, is one of the ways of recreating reality in a much more benign form. So even if it involves reporting your pain, there's still a sense of control about it. And the other thing is that by making a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end, you give shape to an existence that may really feel very chaotic. And giving shape to the world through your writing is another great sort of benefit of doing it. So I think those are the two things that drew me to writing in the first place. And I never thought it would end up, you know, being a career, but I did it as an emotional necessity.
I mentioned in the introduction that you were born and raised in the Bronx. What was that like? What was your upbringing like?
It was the Bronx. No, you know, I mean, you know, it has this mythical status that you say, oh, I'm from the Bronx. It's like, whoa, you survived. Yeah, of course I survived, you know. And it was a working class borough full of working class kids, very, very vital, very sexual. I lived mostly in an Italian neighborhood, so that meant I sang a lot of rock and roll on the streets with my neighbors. But I lived in a housing project. It was rather decent, I think. The image of housing projects, you know, you feel as if a brick is going to fall on your head at any moment. And this, of course, is not the reality of it. It's just, you know, working class life. And for my parents, it was actually a big step up because they grew up in cold water tenements with toilets in the hall and things like that. So for them, they were in paradise. I enjoyed it too. It's just that I wanted a life in Manhattan. And the values of my neighbors, I felt very alienated from those values. And of course, especially when it came to race, where my neighbors had extremely negative opinions and feelings about people of color, even though they belonged to groups that 50 years earlier hadn't even been considered white. So for me, that was a really horrible thing. And all of my alienation kind of focused on my anger at their racial feelings. Eventually, I got to see an actual race riot in the neighborhood in which my white neighbors, you know, arose against the idea of black people working at a hamburger stand.
Right. And you talk about that in the book as well. You say, continuing on with race, that race was the core of nearly everything in the 60s.
Yeah.
And you were drawn to the civil rights movement. There's a whole chapter called White Like Me, and
yeah,
it may be unfair to choose one paragraph, but there was one that really struck me. Do you mind if I read that?
No, sure, please.
For us, whiteness was a shelter from the storm, and I wasn't ready to give it up entirely. I was willing to fight for blacks, but not to feel like one of them. When we marched together, holding hands, I had to suppress the impulse to recoil, as if something might rub off. I prayed that the stiffness in my body wouldn't show. Over the course of the 60s, I came to understand that this wasn't just a problem for Jews like me. Every white person had a racist back alley. We were all victims of our history. In one way or another, millions of Americans my age went through this process of self-examination, whether or not they ever marched for civil rights. The current etiquette of respect is one result. I'm afraid it's the best my generation can offer, but given the course of human history, it's no small thing. Wow.
Well, you know, maybe this is my sort of apologia or justification for the fact that we haven't made more progress in terms of racial justice. And apologies are due. I mean, here I was, a member of the civil rights movement. I went to the March on Washington and heard Martin Luther King. I participated in work and jobs demonstrations in New York City. I was deeply involved in the movement as a kind of foot soldier, and I witnessed a lot of violence as a result. But even though I was totally committed to this goal, I still had these feelings in the back of my mind about not wanting to be fully implicated in the lives of black people. And so, yes, an apology is due and an explanation is due. So I think almost every white person my age has this double experience of transitioning to a new world where justice is at least a possibility and still being mired in an old world in which, God, I'm glad that's not me, you know, who has to go through this. And I think for Jews, you know, there's this kind of maybe a special experience in which the vast history of oppression suddenly is projected onto another group. And on the one hand, you have this enormous empathy with the group, the new oppressed people. On the other hand, there's this horrible sense of relief that it isn't you anymore. And both of these things are going on at once. So I wanted to try to express the complexity of my feelings, which I think are also true of many people my age. And it's this complexity that made everything so sort of difficult, you know. On the other hand, it gave us an impetus to explore new ways of being with each other. And my commitment was genuine. I mean, I participated, and I'm very proud of that. But nevertheless, emotionally, there was much more ambivalence than I was willing to admit. And this is just something that I think we all, each of us has to confess. If you don't really understand your latent racist feelings, and your sense of being wedded to your privileges, you'll never really come to terms with it. So, you know, this kind of self-examination is completely essential for us. And that's what I was trying to get at in the book, is to examine the reality of my feelings.
And yet we're still involved in racial tension. I mean, it's still very fresh.
Yes, and I have survivor guilt in a way, because, you know, actually, I thought that it actually would be possible for my generation to actually do away with racism as a public fact. Because it was so absurd, so patently absurd, it seemed to be possible to completely dispel it. And yet we see that, in fact, it isn't dispelled, that it's the entire way the country is organized, and that in the areas where you would think race has nothing to do with this, it actually does. So whether you're looking at policing or whether you're looking at educational records, whether you're looking at housing or almost any other issue, even the behavior of the president. You know, I was teaching my students, I teach a course in the 1960s, and I was talking about John F. Kennedy and how sexually forward he was, and asking them why Obama isn't this way. And I think race has something to do with that. It would be much more threatening if a black president were as flirtatious as John F. Kennedy always was in his press conferences, for instance. Hmm. So, you know, even something like that, you know, traditional male behavior, if you want to call it that, is mediated by race.
What kind of response did you get from your students?
Well, they agreed. I mean, they're much better versed in these things than I am. And they understand, you know, a phrase like white privilege is a very common phrase to them. So, but they hadn't thought of it. But it made perfect sense to them that it needed to be thought about.
I'm talking with Richard Goldstein about his book, Another Little Piece of My Heart, My Life of Rock and Revolution in the 60s. Richard, you got married, and you explain at that point that there were all sorts of living arrangements possible, but you wanted something more permanent. What was going on for you at that time?
Well, love, for one thing. For another, I think a desire for some stability in the midst of all this chaos. I mean, journalists live in a kind of state of benign chaos. Mm-hmm. Every disaster is an invitation to have an experience.
Right.
It really does warp your mind after a while. And, you know, there needs to be a hearth somewhere in your life. And I think, you know, my wife and I both felt this way. So we married very young. And it was, you know, I think a very good marriage that lasted about 5 years. And then finally, you know, broke up. And you know, my sexuality was really shifting at the time. And so eventually I had to acknowledge that I had sexual feelings toward my own sex, and I had to deal with that. So the marriage had to end for that reason. It ended for existential reasons. And I often think that when you have a good relationship and it ends, it's usually an existential issue, not, a withdrawal of affection. So that's what happened in my case. So the marriage was real, but I was changing, and these changes had to be expressed. So there was really no other option.
Well, the wedding sounded pretty wild. You had the Velvet Underground. that was a shocker.
I mean, the Velvet Underground, I know, but they were just there, you know. I mean, they were on the scene, and it didn't seem that extraordinary that they would play at my wedding. You know, it might as well, I don't know, it's like having some kind of magic wizard be present, you know, at your wedding. But they were just people on the scene, you know.
It didn't feel like having a magic wizard at the wedding?
Well, what felt magical was my wife wearing a paper sari as a wedding dress and me wearing silver go-go boots. That was more exotic than the Velvet Underground to me. But, you know, those are real 60s images, I think,
yeah.
You know. And the wedding was held in a discotheque. The host was Murray the K. And, you know, the whole thing was a complete 60s kind of extravaganza.
And the music scene was very embedded in all aspects of your life. I mean, your honeymoon, you went to Monterey Pop?
My honeymoon was in Monterey Pop, yes.
What was that experience like?
Well, you know, Monterey Pop was a remarkable event. It had the greatest rock lineup that had ever been in on a single stage. And it really is the model of the modern music festival, except, first of all, there are no corporate logos in sight. You didn't have to look at the performers on big screens from, you know, sitting a mile away. You're not paying $350 to camp in mud, which is what happens today, you know. So it's a much less corporatized event. And that was the big difference, I think. I mean, the industry hadn't yet learned to co-opt the counterculture. And the revenues, at least allegedly, went to the musicians. So all of this stuff, you know, is very, very different from today. The lineup was extraordinary. I mean, this is the first real performance of Janis Joplin. This is where Jimi Hendrix really becomes a superstar, preceded by The Who, and one can go on and on. The whole thing was an extraordinary experience. You know, the film Monterey Pop is one of the great music films and really is worth seeing. Jimi Hendrix, when he decided to burn his guitar with lighter fluid, threw it out into the audience, and I was in the front row. So it whizzed over my head, and my colleague Robert Christgau caught it. He made a World Series catch and caught the guitar, at least the remnant of it, which he kept in his apartment until somebody lost it. I mean, the whole idea of not hanging on to an object like that is also very 60s. I mean, I had a whole run of psychedelic Fillmore posters given to me by Bill Graham, and I just glued them up on the walls. So when I left my apartment, there was no, you know, they were gone. I couldn't get them at all. You just did not hang on to things. There was no notion that there would be an antiques roadshow.
Right.
That somehow these posters would be worth thousands of dollars. It never would have occurred. You know, the sort of motto was, don't hang on. If it's beautiful, put it up on the wall, but don't hold on to it. So most of my rock memorabilia has gone the way of those posters, I'm afraid.
That's too bad. At one point, you talk about how you felt like you were losing the distance from the musicians you were writing about.
Well, I mean, the music became industrialized very rapidly. The record industry just closed in on it. A lot of money was sort of dumped on musicians. They had a lot of freedom in the studio. The result was very rapidly the creation of a kind of stylized, standardized version of the counterculture. So as it spread, it grew more banal. And this happened very quickly. It happened in a space of about a year and a half. So the music became less and less communitarian, less and less original, less and less provocative. And on top of that, there was all of this insurrection going on in the country. There was racial insurrection, and there was anti-war insurrection. And these two forces combined produced the greatest period of civil unrest since the Civil War. And as that revolution, as it was called, and we called it the revolution, as that progressed, the music became less and less interesting to me, and I was more and more interested in what was going on in the streets. And musicians did not play in the street. There was no There's no place for them to plug in, for one thing. And for another, they weren't interested in that kind of risk. So I realized that the music they made that sounded so revolutionary was really a representation of something that was really going on around us. And so that's really sort of what I focused on, the real thing, rather than the representation.
You were dismayed with the music industry, and who could blame you, and some of the musicians themselves along the way. What was going on in the music business and for you when you came to the conclusion that it was tough to have a revolution that hinged on turning a profit?
Yeah, well, you know, record executives in Nehru collars with beads around their neck, you know, special rooms to hear records for critics that had hashish available and things like that. And this, the general sort of distance between these titans of the record industry and the actual motivations of musicians. I mean, there were some really important exceptions to this. There were some producers, for instance, who were extremely close to the musicians. But the industry itself was just basically, you know, a profit center. And so the entire counterculture itself became a profit center. And, you know, everything was merchandised. Very little of it had its artisanal roots, which is where it began. So all of this stuff really drove me crazy, and it was very hard to figure out what was authentic when so much money was to be made. Psychedelic bar mitzvahs and what have you. So finding, you know, the level of authenticity was just more and more of a task.
What years are we in?
Well, 67, by 68. This had really begun already. By the time people were lighting matches at the ends of concerts, that's really where you saw these rituals take the place of anything spontaneous. And, you know, for me, that was really a bummer, as we said. Mm-hmm. And it just led to a significant depression. But the real cause of the depression was the deaths of these musicians. Once that happened, it became very hard for me to think about writing about music anymore. Just listening to a record could reduce me to tears because I knew the person who made the record and the person had died. Furthermore, the person had died at a very young age of drugs. And this, you know, caused a tremendous conflict because, you know, one sort of facilitated this behavior without really thinking about it, and especially without taking care of these people. You know, the 60s is a time of libertarianism. It's the left-wing libertarianism, not the current libertarianism that we have. Left-wing libertarianism is about sharing your property and, you know, having a common property. But when it comes to behavior and ideas, having no control by the state at all. Right-wing libertarianism is about keeping your property. Left-wing libertarianism is about sharing it. So that's the difference. But still, it's libertarian. And this libertarian ethic meant that somebody who was in the process of destroying themselves was basically doing their thing. And this ethic struck me as being really, really merciless and very difficult. It was hard not to see that in some sense I was colluding in this ethic by writing about it, just by writing about the behavior. So a time of intense confusion resulted in which I basically just couldn't write anymore. And I withdrew from writing about music. So my whole career as a music writer lasted about 4 years. At the end of it, I was completely burned out and I cut my hair. This was just the act of utter despair, you know?
Do you feel like you were the only one who felt that way as far as critics were concerned?
I don't know. Maybe. It might be that I started out with expectations that were way too high. And so, you know, seeing what actually ensued, I couldn't cope with it. Other critics who were less sort of wedded to the ideals, who had a more realistic grasp of what music was for, they were probably better able to cope with all the sort of complexities of what happened. In my case, I really thought that music was a tool of the revolution. And I thought of myself as a cultural worker, not a critic. You know, writers called themselves cultural workers. And so, you know, that was my sort of goal, was to sort of be a catcher in the rye for mm-hmm. the counterculture. And when the counterculture couldn't endure, there was nothing to protect anymore. And so it was immensely disillusioning. I mean, but I've spoken to a lot of rock critics who went on to see music just as music, or to went on to see it as just an embodiment of American themes. And those people, I think, were in a much sturdier place to continue. So we have some terrific music critics from the 60s. There are several of them who are geezers now, who do remarkable work, of course. So, you know, and I mentioned Robert Christgau and Greil Marcus as two examples. And now, today, the field of rock criticism has changed enormously, and there are many, many more women in it, which makes an enormous difference.
This is Richard Goldstein, and we're talking about his book, Another Little Piece of My Heart. It's a memoir of his life and career as a journalist and rock critic in the 60s. We're going to take a break, and we'll continue our conversation when we come back. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith Middleton.
From this lonesome town.
This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Laurie Mack, sitting in for Faith. We're talking today with Richard Goldstein. He's a journalist, author, and former rock critic. He created a new genre of criticism at the Village Voice in the 60s. His work has appeared in many publications, including the New York Times, Harper's, New York Magazine, and he's written several books. His latest is called Another Little Piece of My Heart, My Life of Rock and Revolution in the 60s. In the book, you make some admissions that you say straight out you aren't proud of, but some of them seem more like lessons you learn along the way as a young journalist. Is there one that sticks out as particularly egregious to you?
Well, I have a feeling that the thing that is most kind of egregious is taking advantage of people's weaknesses and putting meanings on them that weren't necessarily true, sort of using the intimacy of the encounters in ways that serve the purposes of journalism rather than the individual. So, for example, you know, listening to Leonard Cohen urinate and seeing that he didn't have a hearty stream, as we might call it, and making an issue of that as if somehow this is an emblem of his neurosis, when he could have had a finicky prostate or something. I know that sounds like a sort of a gross thing, but it made a great detail in the story. And it just struck me as being a real violation, you know. And anything that I did that was on that level, where I sort of assumed things based on the reality of the detail, and I gave it a kind of valence that maybe it didn't have, all in the interest of creating a character sketch, those things bothered me a lot, and they still do. I mean, a human being is not a story. And when you read a story, you're not actually encountering a person. You're encountering a character. And the demands of making a well-made story are very different from the possibility of really conveying the reality of a person. And, you know, as a young journalist, I didn't have the skills to really navigate this difference. And my readers were always delighted to hear, you know, salacious details of one sort or another. But today I would take much more care to really, you know, both respect people's privacy and also, you know, try to convey the complexity of their personalities. In those days, journalism is the art of the quick take. So In those days, I just, you know, came in at 8 at night, wrote my story overnight, and the editor took it at 6 in the morning. And so it was necessary to kind of eclipse complexity a lot. And that's probably my greatest regret.
But most of these things sound really like honest, growing up mistakes that you're making as a young person, very young person, in journalism. I mean, I know there are mistakes that you've never forgotten, but it's, don't you think, maybe part of growing up a little?
Yes, sure. Except that it's still a real piece in a real newspaper that, you know, potentially lasts forever. Mm. And a real human being is you know, written about in public, and then an image is created with thousands of people, maybe millions of people, absorbing that image. So it's not just some kind of error you make where you're rude to somebody on the street and you wish you hadn't been. It has real consequences in people's lives. So that's why it's much graver in a certain way, you know. It's like doing painting of somebody as a young person and putting horns on their head. You know, it has consequences. So it's the consequentiality of it, I think, that And even then, I was dissatisfied. But as I got older, I became more and more dissatisfied and more determined to try to actually capture a human being in my writing. And it may be that the best way to do that is to write a memoir, because mm-hmm. you're capturing yourself, finally. Mm-hmm. So there's, in a way, there's a reduced responsibility when writing about yourself. You know, you can only hurt yourself. It's okay. It's not the same thing as hurting, especially somebody who ended up overdosing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those are the things that I most regret.
Well, let's go to the lighter side of regrets. You tell a story in the book, and I'm sure you've told this over and over again. It has to do with reviewing the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper album for the New York Times. Can you tell that story?
Right. Well, you know, I was a huge Beatles fan, and the Times had never reviewed a rock record because, as usual, they were way behind the curve. So they commissioned me to review the album, and expecting a rave, but I didn't like the album. And I wrote a very critical review of it, and the result was that the newspaper got thousands of letters of protest. And today, you know, there are many critics who think I was right. It's really not a good album. You know, it's too studio-oriented. It's too cluttered and hip. It's pretentious, blah, blah, blah. And then I realized, actually, that I was quite wrong, that it is a great album. It's one of the seminal works of postmodernism. You know, it's really a work about identity and the mutability of identity. It has the essence of the hippie worldview. So I, in my usual self-righteousness, panned it because it didn't seem like rock and roll to me, because it didn't follow the rather rigid rules of pop. Every song on the album had a different style. Very little of it actually was rock and roll. Mostly the only thing that tied it to rock music was Ringo Starr's drumming, and in some places there wasn't even drumming. So the work didn't fit anywhere, nor was it respectable avant-garde music. So, you know, I was at a loss to how to categorize it and how to cope with it. And so what it really revealed to me was my own limits as a critic. And I think that what a really honest critic has to understand is his or her fallibility. So to be willing to be wrong and to acknowledge that, to change your mind, these are rare skills in a critic, but that's what I look for. And I think the best critics are those who don't rest in peace.
Mm. To what extent do critics shape our opinion of music?
Oh, very little. Very little. There's less power in terms of making a record important than there is in any other field of culture, I think. In pop music, it's entirely the audience that makes the decisions, and the critics follow up and try to cope with whatever the public has decided that it admires. So mostly music critics will sort of tell you why something is good. They won't sort of predict what's good. I think this is a very healthy stance, because I think pop music should be a populist form, and the critic really shouldn't be in the position of determining what you go and buy and listen to. The critic should simply react to your reaction. So I think that's good. I think that's a very progressive way to do criticism, and I think the best music critics do that. They synthesize the public's taste and explain why it's related to larger currents in the culture.
So we've talked a little bit about this, but you talk in the book about how shy you were when it came to talking to some celebrities, but you used your shyness and you turned it into a personal style. I guess what I'm getting at here is that you didn't just write about the music, you wrote about the scene as well. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think I didn't have a choice, you know. I was completely tongue-tied around these people. I was genuinely in awe of them. The reason I went into this in the first place is because I was an enormous fan. So I didn't have any skills beyond my fandom. And so when I met these people, I would, you know, I would be in a state of sort of awe and terror. And basically, I brought out their own personalities by doing this. I would come with only a few questions, and they would basically take over the interview. So they got to talk about whatever they wanted to talk about. And, you know, usually they weren't interested in talking about superficial things, but about the real issues in their music. So I would just sit there and listen, and I barely directed the interview in any way. I think this is a good strategy for a critic, actually, but for me it came out of necessity. You know, I don't know what this would be compared to meeting Bob Dylan. It's kind of like meeting a sort of minor deity, and generally you don't say much around the deity. So that was my strategy. With strategy, you know, grew out of my actual personality. And I'm still this way around artists I admire, and I'm completely shy around them.
This is Richard Goldstein, and we're talking about his latest book, Another Little Piece of My Heart. It's a memoir of his life and career as a journalist and cultural writer in the 60s. I want to talk about your experience when you first went to San Francisco. You all along the way expressed your doubt in yourself, the events that were taking place, and so forth. But you were such a keen observer. You, on one hand, desperately wanted to let yourself go and really experience what you were seeing and be part of the scene, yet you seemed to instinctively know that this scene could end badly.
Well, I guess I had apprehensions about where it was going because a lot of it was irrational behavior. Mm. I think there was a feeling that you should try anything that felt good because you could no longer trust the formulas that you had been presented with as a child. And so there were no rules at all and no sense of what would work and what would cause difficulty. So I think that was really a great aspect of the 60s because it meant that the future was entirely open to be recreated. On the other hand, it posed a lot of danger because people didn't know where the edge of the cliff was and they just sort of went over it sometimes. So when you saw this happening, you know, on the one hand, there was this enormous feeling of exhilaration because there were no limits, no limits at all. On the other hand, there was this feeling of apprehension because not having limits means that there's tremendous danger in the air. So both things are going on at once. On the one hand, the idea of creating a new reality. On the other hand, the nightmare of creating a new reality. And both the things are happening simultaneously in that era. And that's sort of the essence of what makes the 60s distinct. There's always the question of whether it's a dream or a nightmare. Mm. And there's no answer to it because it's really both.
And speaking of danger, I can't let you go without talking about your friendship with Janis Joplin. She meant a lot to you.
Well, you know, the reason I think we bonded is because we were both highly insecure people. And people who have doubt about themselves, this kind of chronic feeling of doubt, they recognize each other. So I think we knew pretty instantly and instinctively that we were similar in that respect. She was a role model for millions of young women, and yet she thought her body was extremely unattractive. She was constantly carping about her hair, which millions of women imitated. She exuded insecurity and a kind of compensatory aggression. And when she got up on stage to perform, she just filled all the neediness within her. And that was very obvious, watching her from backstage. So, you know, that was the basis, I think, of us bonding. And basically, we hung out together when she was in New York. I think I grew to like her very, very much. I would say she's the person I love most in the pop music industry.
And
but she became a kind of ward of the industry at a certain point, especially when she left her original band, which had formed a kind of protective nimbus around her. And when she joined this super band, they didn't have the same relationship with her. So I think she ended up being neglected in many ways. And nobody really stopped her downward spiral. Mm. And I lost track of her as well. So when I read that she had died at the age of 27, I was devastated by it. And it sort of encapsulated all the sort of danger and uncertainty of the era. For me, it became the time when I found it necessary to completely withdraw. I think a lot of people my age did that at the end of the 60s. They withdrew. They withdrew into cocaine. They withdrew into black clothing. They withdrew into irony. They withdrew into punk. They withdrew especially into real estate. And that's why I think the 60s collapsed. It collapsed in a state of pain. In reality, though, of course, many of the things that were so difficult, like a difficult birth, actually evolved into the present and had an immensely influential impact on the present. So, you know, it's like a Yeatsian paradigm for me. You know, a terrible beauty is born. And that's, I think, what I get out of the 60s. You know, it's the forge of the present, and so it's very hot.
The only equivalent that I have been able to come up with when it comes to Janis Joplin and modern times is Amy Winehouse.
Uh-huh. Yeah, sure. There are a lot of similarities. And you know, so the ritual of self-sacrifice, the performer who is rewarded for being self-destructive, and the great art that comes along with that is still present. Sure, there's still the need for that kind of spectacle, and maybe more even for women. That is, to see a woman do this is, I mean, one can talk about Judy Garland in the same way, I think, or Marilyn Monroe. So there's a whole series of female performers who undergo this. Carmen Miranda is another one. You know, these kinds of things are built into the culture, and it's something that we should be critical of. But it's also maybe an important part of touching your inner self to see somebody actually reveal herself in these terms. And again, I'm not sure whether the drinking and the drug taking aren't an essential part of touching that sort of hidden, forbidden self that we need to access through art. You know, again, it's almost inevitable that somebody would be involved in drugs and alcohol who plays this sort of shamanistic role.
Can you talk a little about the experience of writing this memoir? It sounds like it was painful to write.
Yeah, like five drafts of pain, you know. Yeah, you have to kind of wring it out of yourself. You have to sort of say, you know, I'm not really getting at how humiliating this was, or I'm not really getting at how bad I felt when this occurred. On the other hand, there's all this exhilaration and joy and the sort of wonderful comedy of seeing people behave when there are no rules. So the result is almost always comedy. Almost all comedy involves the breaking of rules, whether they're the rules of logic or the rules of etiquette. So there's a lot of fun in it, too, a lot of absurdity. But the pain involved really being able to sort of get on the page precisely how upsetting a lot of these things were to go through. But again, I mean, I think it's upsetting the way The Catcher in the Rye is upsetting.
Yeah, right.
Now, any good book about youth is going to be painful. So I think that any honest account of anyone's youth is going to have a lot of pain in it. Maybe we're too concerned with safety today to understand that having an adventurous youth invariably involves pain. I mean, there's a white whale, you know, who's threatening to overturn your ship. And if you're Ishmael, that's really scary. On the other hand, that's the adventure of his youth. So I think pain, expressing pain, is an important part of coming to terms with your own youth.
It's a great place to end. What are you working on now?
I'm trying to decide what to work on now. I had an interesting enough life after the 60s as a journalist, and I may write something about that. You know, I have a novel. I'm interested in the revival of Puritanism in our time, because it so counteracts a lot of what we believed in the 60s. If you take the 60s and you remove the progressive economic agenda of equality and you remove the agenda of racial justice, then you get the present. In other words, without the economic equality, you get the anxieties of the present, the sort of obsession with safety, the sort of turning away from sex, the micromanaging of consent, all of these things that really fly in the face of the 60s, to me, they're what happens when you actually get a kind of focus on the personal that doesn't have any real economic agenda attached to it. So the fact that we're a much more unequal society than we were in the 60s lends itself to a certain obsessiveness on the part of middle-class people, and that focuses on sex a lot. So that's sort of the beginnings of a thesis that I'm interested in pursuing here. You know, what happens when you actually do away with the socialistic intentions of the 60s is that you get this kind of focus on the body and its dangers. And I'd like to explore that.
I hope you do. I love your book. Thank you for talking with me today.
Well, it's a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
The book is called Another Little Piece of My Heart, My Life of Rock and Revolution in the 60s, by my guest, Richard Goldstein. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith Middleton. Thanks for listening.